You're listening to All Things Cage at Wavefarm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is the multi-talented John Kelly, an award-winning singer, dancer, and writer, as well as performance and visual artist. His performance works range in scale from solo to larger ensemble and stem from autobiographical, cultural, and political issues. Subjects have included the Berlin Wall, the Troubadours, the AIDS epidemic, and expressionistic film. And his character studies have been based on such figures as Caravaggio, Artaud, Joni Mitchell, and Jean Cocteau. His works have been performed at such hallowed venues as Lincoln Center, the Warhol Museum, the Whitney Biennale, PS 122, BAM's Next Wave Festival, and London's Tate Modern. Kelly has collaborated with many leading composers, including John Cage, in whose works he's prominently appeared. These include James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and Alphabet, Lecture on the Weather, Aria with Fontana Mix, and The City Wears a Slouch Hat, this last in a staged version at Bard College in 2012. We'll talk today about his leading role in Cage's Alphabet, which he created for its initial run of performances around the world in 2001-2002 in a stage version directed by none other than me under the auspices of the John Cage Trust. Before we begin, however, let me give a thumbnail sketch of the work. Cage's James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and Alphabet began life as a radio play in 1982, a commission from Klaus Schoening and Cologne's WDR. Cage brings together 14 unlikely characters, many of them near to his heart. The title characters, Joyce, Duchamp, and Satie, along with Mao Tse-tung as a child, Henry David Thoreau, Rose Célavie, Thorsten Veblen, Buckminster Fuller, Jonathan Albert, Robert Rauschenberg, Vocorder, Oppian, Brigham Young, and a narrator who keeps everything on track. The characters are made to speak in monologues consisting of literal quotations, freely adapted historical materials, and lines Cage has simply made up. Given the unlikely cast and the liberties taken, Alphabet is a remarkably democratic intermingling of perspectives, tinged with unmitigated humor and an unmistakable irreverence for the particulars of history. Our staged version of Alphabet was set within a graceful stair-step structure designed by the Finnish architect Marco Steinberg that pretty much filled the stage. The entire cast of characters remained in place upon it, the narrator alone moving freely about, a charismatic circus ringleader who seemed to orchestrate the entire affair. Music, which consisted of a digitally constructed mix of background and cued sounds, made a steady appearance in an amazing realization by New York composer Michael Rouse of an unfinished score left in fragments by John Cage. The cued sounds were performed live on stage by James Joyce, played by Michael Rouse, who was seated at a digital keyboard. The lighting was created by the designer James Ingalls and his assistant Nicole Pierce, the entire setting becoming a book come to life in a manner akin to illuminated manuscript, the players shifting slowly upon their simple benches in a kind of minimalist choreography, strike intermittent poses in what becomes an ever-changing tableau. Of the 14 characters comprising the work, only five, the narrator, Duchamp, Joyce, Satie, and Brigham Young, traveled with the production. In our original run, the actors, in addition to Kelly as the narrator and Rouse as James Joyce, were David Vaughan as Duchamp, Merce Cunningham as Satie, and Trevor Carlson as Brigham Young. With two characters appearing only on tape, Rose Célavie, played by Jasper Johns, and Vocorder, played by the Australian performance artist Melissa Madden Gray, the remaining seven players of more modest locutions were locally cast in each new venue. The piece was performed without pause, lasting about 70 minutes, with a libretto made available to audiences to assist in their real-time comprehension of dialogue and identification of the characters on the stage. In its initial run, Alphabet was seen at the Edinburgh International Festival, the Hebbel Theatre in Berlin, the Dublin Fringe Festival, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Champaign-Urbana, Cal Performances in Berkeley, the Perth International Arts Festival, and UCLA Performing Arts. We performed the work once more a decade later in the Sosnoff Theater at Bard College's beautiful Fisher Center for the Performing Arts with many of the original cast members. As Merce Cunningham had passed away in 2009, his character, Eric Satie, was heard only on tape, in Merce's voice, with visual remnants of Satie on stage, a black bowler hat and a cane, making a somewhat ghostly appearance throughout on Merce's otherwise empty bench. Welcome to All Things Cage, John. Can you still do your part by heart?
You know, it's funny because I listened to it just this morning and I had not heard it in so long. And with the listening of it, there was a lot of proximity memory, of muscle memory, of visual memory. So who knows, you know?
Right. Just to clarify for the listening audience, I said it, but I should say it again. You are the only moving part in this production. You are not only handling your own really demanding 70-minute text, but you are also the prompt for conversations with other people. You are triggers for the movement of those people upon benches. You're the trigger for Michael Rouse, who plays James Joyce, to play the cued sounds relative to your text or lack thereof. So you have a lot going on. So it isn't just a matter of memorizing those lines, is it?
No, it's, in other words, you better not screw up.
Did you ever? I don't remember there being an instance where you really screwed up.
I think there was one point where I jumped some text and then made my way back. And I think you remembered that moment and assured me that I did okay.
Yeah, it stayed within the framework.
Yeah, but it was a very terror-making endeavor. You know, when we first did it, I think at SUNY Purchase, I had cheat sheets all over the stage and written on my arm. And as you said, the entrances to certain mini speeches or whatever were the things that were most challenging to remember, because the work itself is like a cubist painting in an explosion, re-rendered randomly.
I never forgot. I think the only challenging thing for everybody, you had many challenging things, but for everybody else, it was simply timing, that they need to keep up, that when you cued them by talking to them and they needed to have a conversation with you, they couldn't take twice as long to do that, because everything, all of the recorded sounds for the script were keyed to time. So you guys had to stay pretty much in line. And I've never forgotten, one of the most harrowing things for me was after our dress rehearsal, our first really run, which was at SUNY Purchase for a couple of days. And it became clear in that Merce Cunningham could not remember his Satie lines. Mm-hmm. And so would stop, start, stammer, and throw us all off by, you know, just a really unacceptable amount of time. And how we ended up coming back to the John Cage Trust in New York City. And I think you were there, were you not? Sitting on the bed, you, me, Michael, and Michael Mushala, our agent at the time, or maybe I had you on the phone saying, Eureka, I think I found it. And I took Merce into a recording studio during the week and had him lay down his lines perfectly, by the way, on digital tape. And then we used those in tandem with his live performances, which had a kind of a couple things happened. One was this beautiful echo effect of all of Satie, but it also gave Merce wiggle room if he wanted to stop talking and mime something or scratch his nose or whatever he wanted to do. he was, his lines were going to get done in the proper amount of time. And it worked beautifully, but it was a scary making moment because here was someone who had, just like everybody else, key lines to give within a set period of time. And he had to get those pretty close to that time allotted, and he wasn't. So.
Yeah, and now you've got Merce's beautiful sonorous voice recorded perfectly.
That's exactly right.
But especially in a work like this, if somebody goes up and there's this giant chasm that opens up, it's not going to be helpful.
Right.
Even more so in this piece, because it's not a usual type of journey.
Yeah. Your text, I would say, quantify it against others, but it's interesting that the narrator's text is fairly sensible most of the time, unless it isn't. Very purposely, it's a little off base, but generally speaking, it's sensible from section to section. Whereas the Satie text, being comprised of solely quotations by Satie, who was enigmatic to begin with. Remember, these are all non sequiturs. He's got non sequitur after non sequitur after non sequitur, sometimes in the same paragraph. So he would naturally get lost. You know, which non sequitur am I at now? He didn't have those kind of conversational signposts that the rest of the characters had pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, you're right to a degree, but you know, the narrator's texts are like a series of experiences, but they do shift from one to the other very quickly, abruptly, with no organic, obvious reason or connective tissue. So it really was a question of just, like, I once staged a Pierrot Lunaire, and I was not familiar with Schoenberg's music at all. And it seemed so impenetrable. But then eventually, the more time I spent with it, I realized how highly romantic it is. I think I'd mentioned this to you. So anything is possible. But at the outset, things can be so utterly daunting that you want to run kicking and screaming away from the project, which I did not do.
You did not. You did not. You were heroic. You were actually heroic.
Well, you were my bedrock.
Well, that's good. And you were mine. Yeah. So that's nice to hear. I remember the one time that you were having difficulty. I can't remember what the text is, where you're sitting in the front of the set on the stage and you have a monologue. It's really, you're just talking to yourself. And you really struggled with that. And we ended up putting your text, or at least cues to your text. I don't remember if you put the whole thing or just cues to it, in a newspaper. And then you read the newspaper on the stage. And it was a perfectly reasonable solution to help you in that moment. Not unlike writing on your arms or your hands, except you were given a prop. Here's a prop for you to work with.
Which may have been like the only prop in the piece, right?
There was one other, and that was the fellow who played Henry David Thoreau.
Right.
He had a book, and he could not remember his lines. This was the vice president of the Bank of Scotland. Uh-huh. We won't name names, but he did a beautiful job when he did it, but he couldn't remember his lines, and he came in. I didn't know what to do with him, and he came in the next day to rehearsal with a book that his secretary had made using pieces of bark as the covers of the book. So it was really Thoreau reading from nature kind of thing. And from there forward, it was fine. But I think that's the only other prop that we used in the whole piece, I think. Something might come to you.
But the thing about this piece, I mean, initially, I come more from dance and visual art, but I went kicking and screaming into acting and speaking, and I was able to do it, but it was never my heart place. With words, one generally has the impulse to find meaning in words, especially when there's one word after another, and audiences are conditioned to find meaning in what may be spoken. And the way that the piece is constructed, it's thwarting the possibility of traditional meaning at every possible turn. So I had to find my own internal body story in there from beginning to end. And the way that you staged it on the bleachers, a very democratic placing of humanity, of bodies, with my body being the only body moving through the scenario. But that visual also gave it another layer of story, you know? So it really kind of reinforced my role as a narrator moving through this Alice in Wonderland or Matrix-like reality, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I totally get that. I would venture a guess though that it does have meaning, it does provide meaning, but it provides it rapidly and briefly. So once you grasp something and you internalize it, by the time you've internalized it and even begin to chew on it, the narrator's off to another one.
No, I completely agree with you. And I understand and agree, yes. And that said, with those bits of meaning, that it's like, you know, making a necklace, accumulation of gravitas, but you got to drag it with you and then add the next one on, and then at the end, make it all make sense or something like that.
Exactly. This explained why you had to get a massage every night. You know?
I think I was having lower back trouble in Berlin. I remember a big kind of hot thing of probably hot red pepper was put on my back.
Oh, it was probably a salon pass, a capsicum pass.
Capsicum, yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. I swear by those. I must have probably sent someone out to get that for you.
Yeah. I kept eyeballing Merce's the little seat that you had on the bench to support his back.
Yes. Merce Cunningham, who played Sati, and it means sitting on a backless. So the little benches are very Amish in their design. They're very simple. And but they had no back. And there was poor Merce, who was approaching, I guess he was around 80 at the time that we did this, maybe 82. And he had a hard time sitting. He would get rounder and rounder and rounder on the bench. And so we ended up actually I had one in the trunk of my car. It was a portable seat that opened up and just supported you from the lower back, if I recall. It was like an L shape. And so that when you sat in it, Trevor had added a tape or something that strapped Merce into it. And it helped him enormously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would sit there and choreograph with his arms at rehearsal, you know, when we're sitting around doing nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's funny, when I was preparing the introduction, I was talking about the fact that it was really just four players who traveled with the work. You know, it was the title characters and the narrator, James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and the narrator. But that's not true. It was five, because Trevor Carlson, who was the company manager for the Merce Cunningham Dance Company at the time, was cast as Brigham Young. And he traveled with the company too, because he was the person who helped Merce on and off the stage, got him strapped into his little portable chair. He had all those, that kind of caretaking going on with Merce during the entire run.
It's funny, because listening to the tape and just thinking of the way that people deliver their lines and the quality with which they might do it, I found the older people like Merce, Jasper Johns, David Vaughn, and Michael Rouse, and also Trevor, actually, were quite beautifully cadenced in their delivery of the lines, where some of the locals that we got were more on the mumbly side occasionally.
Yeah. You know?
And I wondered, is that a generational thing, like the generation that listened to Edward R. Murrow on the radio, and maybe life was at a slower clip. But I just think humanity generally has gotten more mumbly and more blurry. I don't know.
Huh. There's a piece in that.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But Jasper John's voice is staggeringly beautiful.
Yeah. Now, Jasper was one of our two voices on tape, of course. The other one being the character called Vocorder. That was done by Melissa Madden Gray, the Australian actor.
Meow meow.
Meow Meow, that's exactly right. Also known, for audiences who don't know Melissa Madden Gray, she's also known as Meow Meow. And in fact, doesn't reveal her real name to strangers who see her in a bar with a friend like me, and they come over and they say, "Oh my God, you were so great. What's your name?" Silence. And I got in real trouble one time when I revealed her name. Exactly.
Did I do bad?
No, of course not. No. I just mean she wanted to remain incognito.
She's also a woman.
She is blonde.
Yamio is a siren with dark hair. Melissa is this beautiful blonde girl.
It's true. It's true. She was a very good friend of Michael Rouse's, which is how she came into our world. And she was had a beautiful, beautiful, high angelic voice. She could do things with her voice in a really high range that other people couldn't do. But we didn't need that. We were mostly manipulating her voice on tape. But Jasper was amazing. You know, I adore him. And I took him into the studio to lay down the part of Rose C'est la Vie, which is a Duchamp artwork character. I don't even know how to describe her, but Rose C'est la Vie. And he does the part. And when we got, he did it without stopping. And at the end, I pressed it and I said, okay, if we can go back to about the 8 minute mark, Jasper, you made a mistake in whatever. And he stopped and he said, really? He just couldn't believe that he had made a mistake. And I said, yes, do you want me to play it for you? And he said, I think I do. And so I played it for him and he very kindly redid the dialogue in that one little section, but it was almost flawless. And the same was for Merce. When we decided to lay that down, there were very little double takes on anything. They were professionals, you know.
It's funny, early on also when I was grappling with the text and how to kind of put it across, because it did to some degree need to be performed. It didn't just want to be a neutral, dry reading. It needed to be given some marrow. And I remember at one point having a conversation with Merce, especially, you know, having done some John Cage before this, having met John and Merce and now working with Merce. And I was asking, sheepishly trying to get some advice out of Merce about how to deliver this text. He said, do nothing, objectivity, you know. And I thought, well, in terms of your work, okay, I understand that, like with gesture having its own, you know, quality and meaning and all that. But then I thought, but you also love Judy Garland and Ethel Merman. So trying to put those two things together. And then with you, I was able to be given the go-ahead and permission to embody it in the most honest way I could muster.
Sure. I think that, you know, so talking about this is a misogynistic text. So for our listeners, it's a little tricky to do that if they don't know what a misogynistic is, but a misogynistic, 9 times out of 10, well, always, it's a poetic form that Cage developed, much like an acrostic, except the string goes down the middle to determine the words as opposed to the start of the words, which is otherwise known as an acrostic, A-C-R, where misogynistic is M-E-S-O, misogynistic. But in a misogynistic, 9 times out of 10, the misogynistic itself will be created from what we call source text. It will come from, could be anything. Cage did misogynistics on the words of Jasper Johns. He did them on the words of anarchists. He did them on the words of Satie. He did them on the words of Thoreau. It's a common practice for him. Every now and then, however, he would do a misogynistic which didn't have a source text. He would simply write the misogynistics, which is why you see in Alphabet as much meaning as you do, you know, as many complete sentences, as many sentences that follow each other, that, you know, form a kind of train of thought. It's because I used to say to him, oh, it's a composed misogynistic. And he would say, correcting me, he would say, Laura, they're all composed. Mm-hmm. And I would say, yes, of course, but I mean that there is, and finally I realized all I had to say was there's no source text, that you're devising these sentences yourself following the misogynistic rules that would be followed if there was a source text. And if you listen, John, to any recording that Cage himself did of Alphabet, which he did many, for the listening audience, very quickly, the piece Alphabet is originally a script. It's not scripted. It's a misogynistic. It's a poem that's available in one of the Wesleyan books. So it doesn't have the parts parsed out per se, but the parts are clear to anyone who has that. In making the scripted version for the staged rendition, nothing had to be changed other than to stick narrator colon in front of a passage or satie colon. It was clear whose parts were whose. But if you listen to any reading by Cage or any reading by others who were performing with Cage, they all have imbued meaning, imbued inflection. There is nothing, including John reading, nothing that's flat, you know, that we associate with Cage's own sort of performance practice. Yeah. So you, what you were trying to do is exactly right. And listen to Mertz. He didn't do those lines flat, you know, so he was being a little disingenuous.
Yeah, it was interesting because I had to very quickly, you know, find my own way of doing it. And also having been able to listen to John's reading of the text, and also the idea of the piece being a love letter to all the people that he was influenced by and adored. And then the idea of who is the narrator, who is this core entity engaging the spectators. Making it conversational was the perfect pitch to begin with and to stay on, because that engaged the human capacity to both articulate and understand.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. And I personally think the way you handled it, John, was exactly right, because it wasn't over the top. It could have been, you know, anyone could have reasonably taken that into a more theatrical realm, you know, but you didn't. It stayed within that lovely impossibility of dialogue with the dead. You know, that is in fact what that piece is. It's a intermingling of perspectives. It's an intermingling of words. As I say in the introduction, that it's made up, the text itself is made up of literal quotations, historical facts sort of shaped into lines. And then there's other things that Cage has just simply made up and tossed in there. So in point of fact, I don't think there is one way to do it. Are there any characters in the play, I'm asking it of both of us, who were more or less expressive than others? Naturally so. Do you know what I mean?
In his own oblique and overturned way, James Joyce.
Yeah.
I mean, in the idea of Joyce and the way in which he wrote, and then Michael speaking those lines. So in a way, it all registered like an Irish seduction.
I still have ladies mostly coming up to me about that and saying, oh, and that's Night by Silent Sailing Night by Michael Rouse, right? No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. So, but I think that the piece is forgiving, isn't it? I mean, it forgiving in the sense that it had room for Michael to play Joyce's lines as seductive, as romantic, as nighttime rather than morning. It was all this kind of gauzy, beautiful thing that he did.
The piece is very forgiving in that way, and it's also, but not forgetting, because if you forget any bit of that text, once again, to bring it back to going up, you know, we can have a hole in the room. It's funny, I was listening to Trevor Carlson reading Buckminster Fuller.
No, Brigham Young.
Brigham Young, excuse me.
That's okay.
And the way that Trevor said tour, just unlike anything I've ever heard, you know, so beautiful and so sexy and so insane.
Yeah.
But so deliciously spoken. Tour.
Yeah.
Tour.
I'm thinking about, you know, when he took that on. So Brigham Young was a polygamist. I'm sure everybody knows that. And Brigham Young, why Brigham Young is a character is a mystery. I have no idea why Cage brought Brigham Young into that palette of characters, really, but he did. And Brigham Young was a polygamist. So in the production, I cast Trevor as Brigham Young. And if you'll recall, he had two, sometimes three mute wives who just sat at his feet, stroked his head, you know, his shaved head, even funnier. But Trevor, who is gay, So there was a kind of built-in irony about all of it. And then Trevor decided that his voice was too delicate. His voice was too fey. So do you recall that probably even in the production that we're going to hear a bit of today, he does the part like this.
He's butching it up.
He tries to butch it up, which makes it even funnier when you know that that's Brigham Young. And I think that it was really Trevor's character in a way, all of you in a way, but Brigham Young maybe in particular, which is what really pushed us into making a libretto with a program that had a map. Do you recall this, that we distributed to the audience so that they could, they actually had a picture of the stair step structure and who was sitting where, because nobody moves from their position, except you, of course. You know, everybody stays put so they could see, ah, Satie is in this downright corner. Ah, James Joyce is up there with the keyboard.
Yeah.
So people could be identified as to who they were.
Yeah, interesting how, and I like how you placed like the bleachers are on a diagonal, you know, it gets raked higher as you go back. So down at the bottom of the rake of the bleachers, Merce was on the left, stage left, and Brigham Young was down there, stage right. So the gravitas and physical weightiness of Merce Cunningham being down stage left is what it was. But then maybe to balance that, so to speak, with Trevor Carlson as Brigham Young with his three or so wives hovering around him, gave it an equally weighty corner.
Right. And there was Joyce up in heaven. You know, there was Michael Rouse up in far stage right, up in the very corner with his, you know, digital keyboard in front of him.
And who was upstage left? Was that Mao Zedong or?
No, Mao Zedong was in the middle. You know who I think was up there is
Thoreau?
No, Veblen. Veblen. Thorsten Veblen. It was Victoria Miguel from Scotland, I think. And she was maybe, I don't know that I put anybody in that corner, but she was just off of the corner. And she, I always remember her up there because she's beautiful to look at. She's very fair skinned, but her father is a Spaniard, so she has dark hair, but very pale Scottish skin. But I put her in a hot pink t-shirt, which she hated. But I said, Victoria, this way people will notice you. You'll stand out from the crowd. What color were you in?
I was in, you know, we all had these black kind of stretchy trousers, barefoot. Initially, I was in a beautiful steel gray tank top when I had bleach blonde hair and when I was 20 years younger. But then you made me wear a black tank top, which I didn't like so much.
I did? Oh, the tank top.
Yeah, I had a tank top, yeah.
I don't think.
I was buff.
Was the gray also a tank top?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I was capitalizing on your muscles.
Yeah, I was buff in those days.
Yeah, no, I remember, honey. I remember.
But the other thing I was listening to occasionally in this audio that we have, you can hear the audience reacting, especially when Merce was speaking the lines of Eric Satie. But in terms of the audience reaction, there was often an amount of audible reaction in terms of laughter or Twitter when you mentioned people like Philip Glass or recognizable, or the absurdity of Nijinsky jumping in, you know, so people would react in that way when there'd be just this completely oblique and obtuse reference and story occurring out of nowhere. But there was also a lot of this going on, I imagine, like, where are we? What's going on?
John Kelly just made a gesture of things going over your head.
Like that silence that, you know, is just like, where am I? You know, audiences who are maybe a bit too spoiled and aren't very good at figuring things out on their own, that they need to have everything explained to them.
Yeah.
We're not going to get that in this piece.
Yeah, I remember though, I think the most problematic performance. So we did a tour, I forget how many places we went, 8 or 9. And sort of in the middle of it or so was Dublin. Do you remember doing it in Dublin? At the Tyrone Theater, I think it was the Tyrone, or the Guthrie.
Was it the campus of Trinity College, maybe?
I think it was adjacent to Trinity, or maybe it was the Guthrie Theater on Trinity campus. I don't remember. I could look it up. But anyway, my point was simply that it was Dublin that had the most trouble with Cage's use of language, you know, what he did and didn't do in terms of emotion and meaning.
Yeah, that disappointed me, actually, being half Irish, you know, having
a half
passport.
Me too. I do recall, though, that I had the most noticeable conversations around the subject of expressivity with the local cast in Ireland. So when I would always precede you guys to our venue about a week, I would cast the local parts and I would work with them for that week. And then they'd be ready for you when you all arrived. We'd go into dress rehearsal right away. And it was really the hardest place for me to deal with actors who really, it didn't come naturally to them to say things with not so much expression. They didn't need to say things declaratively or ham things up at all, that it would be funny all by itself, really.
Also, wasn't there, because I know that we went from Berlin to Dublin, and that was right, like, you know, literally Berlin was on September 11th or 12th of 2001. But just, I know maybe we can talk about that if you want to, but didn't the beaches have to be rebuilt for Dublin?
Yes, we could not get our stage set to Dublin. And so they offered to build us a stage set to the same specifications. And in point of fact, the dimensions of it were fine. The problem with it is that it was not finished. Now, our stage set was incredibly beautiful. It was the design and the manufacturer of a Finnish architect by the name of Marco Steinberg. And it was beautiful. It was like fine furniture. You guys were performing on this piece that felt like a beautifully finished piece of Finnish furniture. And so the dimensions of the set that they built for us in Dublin, which, by the way, was built by a company that produced seating and things, those kinds of structures for rock concerts. But the real worry and the real problem in Dublin is that you guys were performing barefoot. Mm-hmm. You were in black kind of stretchy yoga pants and t-shirts, no shoes, partly to protect this beautiful piece of furniture, but also because it just leveled the playing field. You know, no shoes, no noise from the shoes. There were all kinds of reasons to be barefoot, except that I had to go out at the last minute and buy all of you socks because two or three of you got splinters right away because the bleacher was not well finished. It didn't have seven layers of glazing on it.
Neither did my ass, because I got them in my
ass. Exactly right. That's exactly right.
Because literally the actual set was so beautiful. It was like this beautiful blonde wood, but it was so smooth. So I was able to, you know, since I really had to have my role be highly physical and gestural and moving around, but literally I could swivel around on my butt on one of those benches and do a complete 180 turnaround. And I was doing things like that.
I know, honey, I know.
Yeah.
It was terrible. I know. Somebody, it wasn't just one person, a handful of people told me that, remember in Dublin we had, no, it was in Edinburgh. It was in Edinburgh. It was our premiere. So we premiered the work in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival, right? No, the International Arts Festival, not Fringe. And we had the provost of Scotland. I'm pretty sure it was the provost. I can't remember his name. But anyway, a handful of people told me that they came to the production. They really knew very little about it, but they had to come because they heard that the provost was going to be barefoot.
And is that a problem symbolically or what?
I just think they didn't know that he had feet, you know.
Yeah. Or what did they look like?
Exactly, exactly.
After all those years behind a desk.
I'm trying to think of what part he played. Oppian. I think he played Oppian. He had the Greek. I think he had one line or something. I have very fun feelings about the local cast from place to place because they had varying degrees of problems that they presented to the cast, but also they brought certain lovely little things that came associated with them with regard to their characters. Do you remember Mao in we did this run in 2001, 2002. And then a decade later, we did it for Cage's, I can't remember if we did it for the centenary or thereabouts. I think it was before the centenary. I want to say it was 2010, maybe 2011, but we did it at Bard College. Do you remember that? And do you remember that Mao was played by a 10-year-old girl?
Emma Reed.
Yes, Emma Reed, exactly.
The daughter of Buster and Trisha Reed, yeah, of course.
Exactly, and she played Mao because the character of Mao in Cage's work is Mao as a child. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't, that was not a directorial judgment call. It was a child. It was a judgment call to let it be played by a girl, you know.
Yeah. I think it's a five-year-old Mao Tse-tung is
maybe, maybe.
But then I think Emma, at that point, she was still quite young. I mean, she
I want to say she was seven at the most. She's a young lady now.
Yeah, we're friends on Instagram. I'm still friends with Trisha.
There you go. But let's go back to Berlin, because it was the part of the tour where the traveling cast solidified its relationships, because it was such a challenging thing that happened to all of us. We had gone from... I can't remember if Berlin was the next stop. I think it was. I think we went from Edinburgh straight to Berlin.
I was back in New York, though.
You're right. So there must have been a little break between them. I came before you guys. So I was in Berlin with David Vaughan. I don't know why he was there early. I think he went from Edinburgh to visit his brother in London, I think. And then he came to Berlin when I went. Michael was there. Michael Rouse always came early to set up any musical things that he had to set up. I was there for the local cast. And it was the night that 9/11 happened, you guys were all en route. Right. So Trevor and Merce were coming in through London. They saw the Twin Towers go down on the television in London when they got there. So the newscasts, that's when they learned about it. When did you learn about it?
I flew from Newark the night before, and it's so funny because there had been a fire at the airport, so the flight was delayed. Uh-huh. And because of the fact that it was delayed, I never go to bed when I get to Europe, but I went to bed that afternoon. I just had to sleep a little bit. So I knew nothing about this. And I showed up for dinner, meeting while in the lobby, the hotel in Berlin, and the TV is on, everybody's milling around. It always isn't terrible, you know, so that's how I found out. But we sat at a dinner table, passed around this phone, calling our friends in New York. But I remember that Merce was so amazing in that moment, because he really did provide an anchor in terms of daddy figure.
Yeah, no, I remember it vividly. I remember you, John, in particular, you expressing sorrow that you weren't home. That you wanted, because New York was your city, and your city was under siege, your city was suffering, and you felt not guilty, but you just wanted to be home. And here you were in Berlin, where there were ceremonies going on side streets. Do you remember that? There were all kinds of things. There were police everywhere. Yeah, yeah.
People saying we remember the airlift. I mean, it was staggering, the response in Berlin, like street corners with candles. Like
they were mourning. They were really in shock. I remember feeling that they were more shocked by this happening than we were, or at least than I was. You know, I remember thinking, well, you can't go around slapping the world and not get slapped back. You know, it's like, what took people so long to just come back and whack us upside the head? It was difficult, but Merce was an anchor. You know, he was definitely an anchor. But what I do remember is that a couple of you saying after the tour, when we got back to the States and did our United States venues, a couple of you saying that was the first time you'd ever been on tour for such a period and saw nothing of the city. Because everyone would go to performance, get out at 11. We would go to whatever Einstein's, I think it was called. It was a diner kind of place. We would eat until 1 a.m. and then you would all go back to your rooms and you would all watch television. We would watch the reruns of this catastrophe until 7 or 8 a.m. and then stagger downstairs for coffee and then go to dress rehearsal or go to rehearsal in the afternoon. So nobody saw any of the city really, except the movement between the hotel and the Hebbel Theater, which is where we were performing.
Yeah, it was a real, beyond being a bonding experience, both between ourselves, but also with the people that were, the local people that were playing with us. It really was a very welcome hunker down scenario. As you said, Cafe Einstein had always been one of my favorite places. It was so nice to be back there. And the hotel room became beyond our dinners together, the hotel room became a refuge. And then it really was about the focus of the work itself in that beautiful Hebbel Theater.
Yeah, it was really marvelous. And John, I remember when we got there for the dress rehearsal, I think Trevor and Merce hadn't shown up yet. I think they got in the morning, but you, me, David Vaughn, and Michael Rouse were there. And I think I did one of the parts to just fill in for the locals so that they could all get a feeling for how the piece flowed. But I remembered them, the local cast and the staff of the theater, just expressing the most warmth and gratitude that we had showed up, that they said they would have understood if we didn't come that night. And they treated us so lovingly and so gently. I just was very moved by the whole experience.
Well, of all places to be on the planet, how fascinating to be in a damaged city like Berlin with such a staggering history. For me, it felt like a real privilege to be in Berlin at that point, honestly.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I found the entire experience so moving. I also remember, John, when we, and you were a ringleader, I remember this, when we were coming back to the States, we went from Berlin to Dublin. And then after Dublin, we were going on to Krannert in Illinois. And I only had like 4 days between where I had some leeway. But you guys had about a week and a half. And you were given the option of, did you want to go back to New York for a break and then meet us in Krannert, those of us that had to go straight on, or did you want to go to Krannert? And I was avoiding New York like the plague. I was so scared about going there. I was afraid of what I would find. And you were among those that absolutely wanted to go home. You wanted to go check in and be with New York for a few days before you came back and got back on the stage.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be a complete abstraction, even though this was maybe 3 weeks after the fact, because, you know, we went from Berlin to Dublin, but we had like a week in Dublin before we actually started rehearsing or something like that.
Yeah, no. We were away, you know, for probably, I think you're right. It was probably about 3 weeks.
Yeah. So I remember I even have a couple of photos of this that I took. It was me, Merce, Trevor, in a van coming through the Midtown Tunnel from Queens into Manhattan. And even there, you could see smoldering smoke in the far distance of the New York skyline. And then coming in and driving past Union Square Park. I mean, at that point, I lived on 16th Street on the West Side. But really, just that much of the aftermath was enough, because it felt really important to, down the line, be able to understand what had happened to some tangible or palpable degree.
I think it was a really good call on your part to do it. At the time, I couldn't imagine why you would want to do that. I thought you would be devastated. I thought it would be just an emotional wrenching to do that. But you all came to Urbana renewed. It felt like you were all okay.
Well, having lived through the AIDS epidemic, this was piece of cake compared to that, quite honestly.
I'm going to let that be a beautiful close to our conversation. We need to bring it to an end, because I'd like to play a sustained excerpt from Alphabet. Thank you so much, John.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It's been great to get down this Alphabet memory lane here.
I'm glad you feel that way. We haven't had nearly enough time to talk about you, but maybe we can do another program and we can do something on maybe Lecture on the Weather, which was another work that you performed with Jasper Johns.
Yeah, and also City Wears a Slouch Hat, and yeah, okay.
And one more. Oh no, you did Aria
I did Aria with Fontana mix with San Francisco Symphony.
with Michael Tilson Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. Thank you, John. It's been great. We'll talk again. And now on to Alphabet. This is I'm just going to start it at the top and run it as long as we can. Alphabet appears in its original unscripted form in Cage's X, writings 79 to 82, published by Wesleyan University Press. The libretto created for the stage performances of Alphabet, which parses out the parts to the various players, is available from the John Cage Trust or at Amazon.com. Enjoy.
What a joy to have them on the same stage, same time, even though the subject of the play is the curtain that separates them. Justifying the constant moving up and down of the curtain, the ghosts jump back and forth, very slowly, in time with the curtain's phraseology, so that just as the curtain reaches the midpoint between open and close, just at that moment each ghost is halfway through a single jump, both their heads touching the curtain, and just as the curtain reaches the top, miraculously, both of them complete their descents. Both are visible. And, just like magic, as the curtain touches the floor, one of them disappears totally from view, leaving the other all alone in front of the curtain. At that moment, the telephone rings. An automated judge answers it and tells the audience whom the call is for. It's always for the ghost who has just disappeared, who cannot be reached. In this way, we know who each ghost is, but neither ghost is distracted from his jumping. The older one is Eric Satie. He never stops smiling. And the younger one is Joyce, 39. He jumps with his back to the audience. For all we know, he may be quietly weeping or silently laughing or both. You just can't tell. Every now and then, Nijinsky's ghost appears, bringing a telegram to Joyce from Marshall McLuhan.
Do you like that silence, Eosa? Are you enjoying this same little me, my life, my love? Why do you like my wisping? Is it not divinely delicious? Isn't it bad for you? Missy, missy, tell me till my thrill me comes. I will not break the seal. I am enjoying it still. I swear I am. Why do you prefer it in these dark nets, if why may ask, my sweetikins? Long ears is flying. No, sweetest, why would that annoy me? But don't! You want to be slapped, well slapped for that? Your delighted lips, love, be careful. Mind my duvetine dress above all. It's gold and silvy, the newest sex tones with princess effect.
In the middle of one of his jumps, Satie grabbed hold of the curtain, and instead of coming down, ascended. His exit signals the entrance of a jeep, which is truly an automobile. It has no driver. It belongs to no one. It is the invention of a 12-year-old ghost named Duchamp. It is expected to improve the world. It uses neither gas nor oil. It runs on Vichy water. The stage has become a bottle of white wine, and Joyce, no longer jumping, is drinking it. Out of the jeep, we see children going everywhere, including a ghost 4 years old named Heidegger. Technology and population. We hear over a radio a conversation sticking to two words, 55 and 54. It is an argument between Houdini and Satie about which one of them as a ghost is older. Houdini sees a crack in mathematics by means of which at 50, 4 and 5 change places, Satie is delighted and grateful.
Now I see, he says, what people meant. Thank you.
A flash of lightning is followed by a lot of smoke, in which all of the ghosts who are on the stage easily disappear. Houdini and Satie, arm in arm, walk on, accompanied by a Ceylonese ghost, a scholar named Kumaraswamy, and a young actor and musician, Jonathan Albert, who isn't dead at all. He's very much alive. He is speaking in his own extraordinary way, moving at will from one region of his mouth to any of eight others, following a notation involving diacritical marking.
Mine is a movement system, he says. I make the movement and discover the sound.
Meanwhile, Kumaraswamy is whispering a Sanskrit text. Attracted by this duet, Joyce returns post-haste to hum a program consisting of one Irish ballad, two Japanese tunes, one melody by Satie, and three lyrical suites by Feldman. Feldman hasn't yet composed. Normally, this would be impossible, but for Joyce, it's no trick at all. It's as simple for him as for him to be bitten by a radish. A scrap of paper blows on stage. Following words are on it. Joyce, music. He is music. Whether those are just loose words in the air, so to speak, or poetry by M.C. Richards, no one can be sure.
Construction of a four-dimensional eye. From a circle, when seen by a three-dimensional eye, moving above and below until the visual ray falls in the plane which contains the circle. Undergoes many changes in shape, conventionally determined by the laws of linear perspective. Two, for the three-dimensional eye, a sphere remains always the same, whatever the point of sight. But a sphere from the four-dimensional perception, moving in a four-dimensional space, until the four-dimensional rays become visual rays for the ordinary three-dimensional eye, undergoes many changes in shape from three-dimensional sphere gradually decreasing in volume without decreasing in radius to simple plane circle. Light and shade exist for four-dimensional as for 3, 2, 1. Three-dimensional perspective starts in an initial frontal plane without deformation. Four-dimensional perspective will have a cube or three-dimensional medium as a starting point, which will not cause deformation.